Well, what are your expectations of the Christian life? Some of us are naive. We think that if we work hard and we balance that by carving out time for rest and leisure and we make wise decisions, well, then we can expect our lives to go pretty smoothly and pretty enjoyably. Maybe not right now, but just after this busy patch. Ecclesiastes says to the naive, be realistic. Since sin entered the world in what we call the fall, the world has been radically broken. We can't understand life. We can't control life. We can't expect life to go smoothly. That is true for believers as well as for unbelievers. If you're not yet following Jesus and some well-meaning Christian has told you that doing so will make your problems go away, you need to know that that's not true. In this world, it won't make your problems go away. When we trust in Jesus, God instantaneously frees us from the penalty for sin. But then he only gradually frees us from the power of sin in our lives. And it's not until Jesus welcomes us into the new creation that we'll be freed from the presence of sin and all its consequences. And then all our problems will go away. But life in this fallen world will always be frustrating, disappointing, and unsatisfying for the Christian as well as for the non-Christian. We must not be naive, but realistic. Some of us are, by contrast, cynical. Work's a curse. There's never anything good on TV. And even when we think we have made wise decisions, life doesn't go smoothly or particularly enjoyably. And so all we can hope for is that we'll die soon and go to heaven. Well, Ecclesiastes says to the cynic, look for the good in what God has given you. Yes, the new creation will be much better than this one. But our lot in this life is from the hand of our good creator God. And therefore, we need to train ourselves to look for the good in what God has given us. The preacher, perhaps King Solomon, gives us two truths and a command in these first two chapters. First truth, the world is transient and repetitive. Second, there is nothing to be gained under the sun. And then a command, therefore, look for the good in what God has given you. First of all, the world is transient and repetitive. Chapter 1, verse 1, the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Well, one of the preacher's favorite words is this word, vanity. It's literally a breath or a mist. Some of the time it seems to me kind of futile, pointless, meaningless perhaps. A lot of the time it's just closer to temporary, transient, passing. It's a mist, it's hard to get hold of. And it's gone before you've really got used to it being there. Life in this fallen world is transient. Verse 4, a generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. One generation makes the historic decision to join the European Union, and the next makes the historic decision to leave the European Union, and nothing's really changed. The earth is an unchanging stage. But each self-important generation of humanity has little more than a walk-on, walk-off role. Life is transient. And life is repetitive. Verse 5, the sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes round to the north. Round and round goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea's not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. Sun, wind, water, they all look like they're going somewhere, but the reality is that they're going in circles. And we may believe in the inexorable progress of liberal democratic values, for better or worse, but on the longer time scale, the reality is that humanity's going in circles. Verse 8, all things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it, the eyes not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done, and there's nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it said, see, this is new? It's been already in the ages before us. I'm promised that when they eventually finish untangling the tracks, whatever that means, at London Bridge Station, my commute will be quicker and more reliable than ever before. What progress. But you know what I've found out? Since it was opened in 1836, London Bridge has required rebuilding or major modifications in 1842, 1844, 1850, 1854, 1862, 1928, 1941, 1978, and the 1990s. The current work is not going to finally fix everything. I mean, it's just the latest patching up in a world that falls apart. It will soon need doing again. There's no progress to get excited about. Verse 11, there's no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after. How many generations back can you name the occupations of your ancestors? My great-great-grandfather presumably got up early and went to work every day and sweated away for 50 years. But I don't know what he did for a living. If not now, then soon, there won't be a soul on earth who knows what that man did with all his time. Verse 14, I've seen everything that's done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and a striving after wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. There's nothing we can do about the situation, and it's foolish to try. This fallen world and our efforts in it are transient and repetitive. In Romans chapter 8, verse 20, the Apostle Paul is talking about the fall recorded in Genesis 3, but he deliberately uses the language of Ecclesiastes to do so. Because of human sin, he says, the creation was subjected to futility. And that's the word that his Greek Bible would have used when it translated vanity in Ecclesiastes. The creation was subjected to futility, to vanity. The whole creation has been groaning together in the pains of childbirth until now. And not only the creation, but we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for adoption as sons, the redemption of our bodies. In the new creation, it won't be like this. But in this creation, it will. Creation is groaning. We, as someone has written, are either groaning or pretending that we're not. Of course, this isn't the whole truth, but isn't it a relief to admit that it is part of the truth, to stop pretending that we're not groaning? If you feel that your life is transient and repetitive, be reassured that is what the Bible leads us to expect. The preacher's first truth is that the world is transient and repetitive, and his second truth follows. There is nothing to be gained under the sun, that is, in this life. There's nothing to be gained under the sun. This was the preacher's rhetorical question in verse 3. Verse 3, what does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? And the answer is nothing. We climb the mountain, but there's nothing at the top. Toil there has the general sense of everything we pursue in life. And he picks out three such things for further examination. First of all, toil in the narrow sense of work. And he says, toil brings no gain. Our toil, schoolwork, paid employment, the work of managing a home or whatever, that toil isn't achieving anything lasting for us. It's not a means to some lasting end. As we saw in 1 Timothy chapter 6 some months ago, we brought nothing into the world and we cannot take anything out of the world. And so we're obliged to leave the results of our toil to others. So look at Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verse 18. Ecclesiastes 2:18. I hated all my toil in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who'll come after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool. Yet he'll be master of all for which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity. So I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labours under the sun, because sometimes a person who's toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. What has man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? For his days are full of sorrow and his work is a vexation. Even in the night his heart does not rest. This also is vanity. So you get the filing system beautifully arranged, and then you go off on maternity leave, and the fool who replaces you doesn't know one end of the alphabet from the other. What have you achieved? Well, nothing. You work hard, and you save well, and you leave it to your children, and they blow it. What have you achieved? Nothing. Toil brings no gain. It's not that there's no value to our work. We're going to see that work is a good gift from God. We can take pleasure in doing it. But the preacher says, don't view your work as a means to some significant end. Some people work in order to feel valuable, but then you've never done enough. Others work in order to enjoy the weekend, but those weekends start to seem shorter and shorter. Others work in order to retire, but from the veranda of your holiday home, won't it seem a bit odd if you ruined the best 50 years of your life devoted to saving money in order to spend the last 10 years of your life desperately trying to stay healthy enough to enjoy spending it? Have you really gained anything from all that work? Some of us are lucky enough to have paid employment that we basically love. I love my job, but that is rare. It's a recent idea. I think it's a dangerous idea that each of us has a career out there somewhere where we'll get paid to do the thing that we love and we'll find satisfaction in it. Why would we think that? Where's that come from? Be realistic. If you can get someone to pay you to do the things you love, brilliant, don't let me stop you. But most people don't have a career that fulfills. Most people have a job that pays the bills. So if that's what you've got, be reassured. That is what the Bible leads us to expect. Toil brings no gain in this transient and repetitive world. What about pursuing pleasure? The pursuit of pleasure brings no gain. This is in chapter 2, verses 1 to 11. The preacher tries a little experiment, and his summary is in the first verse of chapter 2. So look at that with me. Chapter 2, verse 1. I said in my heart, come now, I'll test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity. We won't read the following verses, but he tries wine, and he tries works, great home and garden renovations, and he tries wealth, and he tries women. He insists that he didn't abandon his wisdom, so don't think of sort of students pursuing drink and drugs and sex. For a king in that culture, these are relatively respectable sort of pursuits. But it's the pursuit of pleasure, of personal pleasure. And in verse 11, he concludes the way he started. So chapter 2, verse 11. Then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil that I'd expended in doing it. And behold, all was vanity and a striving after wind. And there was nothing to be gained under the sun. Pleasure is a wonderful thing to experience, but it turns out that it's a terrible thing to pursue. I read recently of an actress who decided that rather than working, the next phase of her life would be devoted to pursuing her own well-being. She was going to focus on herself and doing the things that brought her pleasure. Well, the preacher's tried that, and he would tell her that this phase of her life is not going to bring her the satisfaction that she's looking for. The preacher doesn't say that the pursuit of pleasure didn't bring him any pleasure. In fact, he says that it did. But it didn't bring him any gain. His pursuit of pleasure didn't achieve anything for him beyond itself. It's vanity, it's a mist that disappears. We know that, don't we? When you're watching a gripping Netflix series, you think that what you want is to get to the end. But when you get to the end, that is not where the pleasure is found. Now, that's where the pleasure stops. The pursuit of pleasure will, of course, bring some pleasure. But it doesn't achieve anything beyond itself. It brings no lasting, no ultimate gain. That is the nature of life under the sun in this transient, repetitive world. Toil brings no gain. The pursuit of pleasure brings no gain. Perhaps most surprisingly, the preacher says that wisdom brings only limited gain and sorrow with it. Wisdom brings only limited gain and sorrow with it. Look at chapter 2, verse 12 with me. So I turned to consider wisdom and madness and folly. Wisdom in the Bible is not mostly a kind of intellectual thing. It's a moral thing. It means living life in line with God's revealed will in the Bible, going his way. And the preacher says that all things considered, it is better to be wise than to be foolish. So verse 13, then I saw there is more gain in wisdom than in folly, as there's more gain in light than in darkness. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. Living God's way in God's world will often work better. If you live life with your eyes in your head, of course you'll end up, you'll avoid some of the potholes that the fool walking in darkness is going to fall into. So for example, if you don't gamble, then it's easier not to fall into debt. But if we think that by wise living, we can kind of manipulate God into making our life turn out nice, we're badly mistaken. 1 Timothy chapter 6 again warns us about false teachers who imagine that godliness is a means of gain. No. End of verse 14. Wise or fool, the same event happens to all of them, particularly death. End of verse 16. How the wise dies, just like the fool. So the wise who get their 5 a day or 10 a day, or whatever it's supposed to be nowadays, those wise people may on average live longer than the fools who eat only bacon. See, wisdom brings gain, but they all die. Wisdom brings limited gain. In fact, there are some downsides to being wise. So chapter 1, verse 18, for in much wisdom is much vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. So the wise spends his life worrying about whether kale or cabbage is the more super of the foods. He probably spends his life smelling of them both too. But the fool lives a short, blissful, unconcerned life, not worrying about such things, and he dies with the taste of bacon on his lips. See, wisdom brings sorrow. Perhaps you're finding, even this evening, this sermon is causing you vexation and sorrow. Do check that what I'm saying really is what the Ecclesiastes are saying. But if so, I'm afraid this is the sorrow that comes from growing in wisdom. It may feel like grieving a death to give up the naive belief that the world's wonderful and life's a treat. But the preacher would urge us to embrace the truth about this fallen world, not only because it's true, but also because, as we'll see, it frees us to take what joy we can from life in this world. And it keeps us looking forward to the greater, deeper, lasting joy of the world to come. In this world, wisdom brings only limited gain and sorrow with it. Sometimes we may be doing all the right things, living wisely, not perfectly, but wisely. And yet things don't seem to go any more smoothly for us than they do for those who have no interest in pleasing Jesus. If that's your experience of life in this world, be reassured. In this transient, repetitive, fallen world, there's nothing to be gained, not through toil or the pursuit of pleasure. Even wisdom makes practically no difference to how our lives will go or what we will have at the end of them. But, in Dale Ralph Davis's words, the preacher is not a cynical old goat who drank Drano and vinegar for breakfast. He has one command for us, and it's wonderfully positive. He says, look for the good in what God has given you. Look for the good in what God has given you. So some of the time, life is going to feel rubbish. Several times, the preacher says things like, I hated life, or I hated my job. I'm paraphrasing. And we're going to have days like that ourselves. But that doesn't need to be the sum of our experience in this world. First, we have to accept that our lot in life, the bits we like and the bits we don't like, comes from the hand of God. So, for example, chapter 1, verse 13, it's an unhappy business in this case, that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. We have to train ourselves to see everything that happens in life, not as the result of blind fate, nor retributive karma. No, everything that comes our way is the gift of a good and loving God, incomprehensible, but good and loving. We don't expect to understand why he's given us this particular lot in life and not that one. But it is never because he is withholding good things from us. On this side of the cross, we can be even more sure of that than the preacher was. Romans 8:32, he who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all. How will he not also with him graciously give us all things? We are to train ourselves to see everything in our lives as a gift from a good God. And we are to train ourselves to look for the good in those gifts. So look at chapter 2, verse 24. There's nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? The ability to enjoy God's good gifts is itself another of God's good gifts. But it's also an active decision for us to make. That expression, to find enjoyment in his toil. It's literally to make his soul see good in his toil. This is a discipline recommended nowadays even by non-Christians. Forbes magazine recently recommended keeping a gratitude journal in order to count your blessings and promised 7 scientifically proven benefits to your physical and mental health if you do so. I don't know who you're supposed to thank if you don't believe in God. Perhaps you're supposed to thank yourself. But Christians know that all good things come from God, and he gives them to us in order that we might enjoy them. So 1 Timothy chapter 6 again, we're not to set our hopes on the uncertainty of riches, but on God, who richly provides us with everything to enjoy. Toil brings no gain beyond itself, so don't work in order to achieve retirement, but make your soul see good in the work itself. In chapter 2, verse 10, the preacher says, my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was the reward for all my toil. So if you've spent the morning compiling a spreadsheet, well, don't worry too much about whether it's a spreadsheet that's going to change the world. Just take some pleasure from the fact that it's a very neat and tidy spreadsheet. You've done it very well. Those rows alternate between pale blue and pale yellow, and that looks kind of nice. Your good and loving God has given you that spreadsheet to work on, and there's something good about it if you can train yourself to look for it. The pursuit of pleasure brings no gain, so don't hoard your annual leave as though if you can only find enough time to focus on your personal well-being, the frustrations of life will disappear. But that doesn't mean that you can't take pleasure in pleasure. Enjoy that glass of wine with dinner from time to time. When the sun rises over the misty fields on your way to school, take a moment to enjoy God's beautiful creation. Make your soul see good in what God has given you. Wisdom brings only limited gain and sorrow with it. So don't start thinking that if you can only get holy enough, then suddenly life will start going smoothly. But it's still better to be wise than to be foolish. We can make our souls see good in living life God's way. We mustn't be naive. This world is terribly broken by sin. Life under the sun. We will not be able to understand it. We will not be able to control it, and we cannot expect it to go smoothly. But the answer is not to become cynical. Now, when we give up viewing toil, the pursuit of pleasure, or even wisdom as means to some greater end, as things that might achieve for us some lasting gain, and well, that frees us up to take what pleasure we can from those things, and there is much joy to be found in life in this world if we will train ourselves to look for the good in the things that God has given us. And better still, the sin that has broken this world has been dealt with on the cross by Jesus. And so if we'll trust in him, we can be instantaneously freed from the penalty for sin. We can be gradually freed from the power of sin in our lives. And one day, we can be freed from the very presence of sin and all its consequences. This world is groaning. And Christians don't have to pretend that they're not. But Christians groan in eager expectation of the perfect new world to come, a world of unmitigated joy and satisfaction in knowing Jesus and his people and the good things that he's given us.